Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this March the 18th on the West Coast, now March the 19th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Well, if you have gotten the March Madness fever and are following basketball, there are a couple of upsets, and there are a couple of predicted outcomes. And while everybody has their attention on that in the United States, the rest of the world is panicking about escaping radiation from two nuclear power plants in Japan. And along with that, it appears, according to news reports, that the supply of potassium iodide has run out, and that it's all been purchased, or that people are selling it on eBay and Amazon.com for incredible amounts of money. As usual, there are solutions. We talked about those on the show last night with Michael Anthony, and the fact that you can get those supplements necessary to protect your thyroid gland in food and in some natural herbs. So despite what's being said by the officials, including the CDC, who says that people over 40 years old should not even consider taking potassium iodide, unless they've been notified by the government. Well, I suppose when we get notification on alien life here on the planet, when we get notification that they're going to do something about the financial corruption, notification that they're going to reduce oil prices or gasoline prices to levels that they were at during the 1960s, or that there is a God, or that they've been brainwashing people in the educational system, I suppose, then we will finally have all the truth. But in the meantime, about all we can do until we bring tonight's guest on board is have a funky good time.
Hit it. How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Play so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, brother? Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. We're gonna have a bunk good time. 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 Now take them up, Fred. We gotta take you high. Ow! All right. You wanna do it again? You wanna do it again, huh?
like this.
We're all sufficiently outside the box. We can let those listening in on other planets know that that was the former godfather of soul, James Brown, singing Gonna Have a Funky Good Time. I guess that's a roundabout way of just escaping for a moment all the insanity going on all over planet Earth. And we're going to talk about that tonight with our regular Friday night guest, who is also our resident science advisor. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and my co-host on Friday nights on Evident Footprints, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, good evening, good morning, whatever.
Yes, Don, thank you for that welcome. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm having a funky good time. What can I say?
Well, it's like the Romans used to say, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Yes. You and I have been talking about power production for a number of years on Evident Footprints. And we talked a couple of weeks ago, we talked about hidden technologies and things that have to be done if we are going to save this planet and if we are going to elevate our consciousness so that we can look forward to moving on when we leave this place. And yet many of us are compelled to feel that we came here for the purpose of undoing what is going on here. So we're approaching this from a solution standpoint, but we've got to look at all the insanity that's going on around the world. We witnessed over the past week or so the the takedown of an entire country, the destruction of an entire country. And you alluded to the fact that it was quite possible that Japan had some technologies that they were going to be bringing out into the market that the powers that be just decided they didn't want to see. And that may not be the only cause or the only reason behind destroying a country's infrastructure, causing nuclear disasters to occur, which can be blamed on seemingly natural events like earthquakes and tsunamis. Yet these things have been done for a number of years, and the information is there. We know that this technology is used, and we know why it's being used, and there seems to be a war going on amongst different countries as to who's going to hold the biggest piece of pie on their plate if they should succeed in carrying out their goals to control the entire planet with impunity. Do you have any comment you'd like to make in that regard, Jim?
Well, I don't think you really want to hear the actual comment that I'd like to make.
Why not?
I just don't think it's suitable for the airwaves. But anyway, one thing that strikes me, you know, as something that is worth saying is the fact that there have been an awful lot of individuals in the past, not only in recorded history, but even in ancient times, where it hasn't been officially recorded, that have been interested in achieving the same goal of world domination. And I just don't think it's a realistic goal. I don't think it'll ever happen. It doesn't matter whether it's done in a direct way with military conquest or if it's done in a more secretive way by controlling the money supply. Sooner or later, when people realize they've been had, there's going to be problems. And I mean problems for the people that started the whole thing. There is not enough military force to police the entire world under the auspices of one dictator. I don't give a darn who he is. So, in my opinion, it's just a matter of time before this idiocy is brought to an end. With respect to your other comments about, you know, the catastrophe in Japan possibly being orchestrated, you and I had talked in the past on different shows about various types of weaponry that were being developed in secret in different parts of the world. As a matter of fact, an old associate of mine, Tom Bearden, had done quite an expose on that. Oh my gosh, it's got to be 25 years ago, where he talked about the possibility of scalar wave weapons being used, you know, to deliver the equivalent energy release to a thermonuclear weapon without the need for a rocket, without the need for a missile or a submarine or anything else. It just the intersection point of two of these specially excited waveforms. We know that all these things are going on and different people have different embodiments of these technologies. And it's not impossible that they could be used on fault lines and in other sensitive areas of the Earth's crust to produce really negative results. And we know that the necessary lack of morality exists. They've already done all kinds of tampering with weather control, with poisoning the atmosphere, with God only knows what else, you know, putting chemicals in our water supply, tampering with the food, altering the genetic structure of the stuff that they sell us to eat, you know. So it should shouldn't be a real big mystery that these animals haven't got any restraints on what they're willing to do, you know, to succeed at their stated objective. And I think that maybe in the long run, if there's any proof that ever emerges that these events in Japan were not things which just happened, but were in fact orchestrated, I think there's going to be negative repercussions from a very angry world, not just from the Japanese. And these yo-yos forget that, you know, they are vulnerable. I don't care how many guards they have or how big their personal armies are. They're not bigger than the total population of the planet. They're not bigger than the total population of any given country. And, you know, they can be done away with. So I think that all of us should keep our eyes peeled for the emergence of any particular truth in regard to these unusual occurrences in Japan. I'm not saying that that's the way it is necessarily. I'm just viewing it with an eye of suspicion, simply because of the fact that I wouldn't trust any of those elites behind a pair of laced curtains.
Mm-hmm. Very well said, Jim, and I'm inclined to agree with you, though I would like to add a question, and from your perspective as someone who is somewhat experienced in physics and understands the concept of nuclear physics, is it logical, is it authentic that an earthquake, which could jolt a nuclear power facility and cause some sort of a problem, would result in the explosion of the roof of the facility? You know, a fire.
Well, you know, I used to work in a nuclear plant as one of the engineers involved with routing of alarm systems and power cables. I won't mention any names, but I can prove my point if I have to. And, you know, they're all supposed to be seismically sound, which means that every bracket, every trough that carries cable or control wires, you know, all those different components, along with such things as motor mounts, you know, foundations, and what have you, are all supposed to be seismically sound up until at least 0.8 on the Richter scale. So I'm not sure what the corresponding specifications are in Japan, but I would imagine that they're similar. If all of those criteria were met, you know, the remaining possibilities lie in the event that something happens to the cooling water. Now, I don't know what kind of a reactor they had over there. I haven't really looked into it, but the reactors that I was familiar with years ago had what they call an emergency cooling toroid, which was a utterly huge steel toroid, which encased the reactor, the majority of the reactor, and it could be flooded with cooling water, in a very, very short period of time to take down the heat if anything should go wrong. Now, the interesting thing is that most of these reactors that are properly designed have what they call a SCRAM system. And the SCRAM system is essentially a list of prioritized alarms, any one of which or various combinations of which can cause a tripping of the so-called SCRAM procedure, which is a little bit different depending on what kind of reactor it is. But primarily what they do is, you know, they'll they'll take the load off the generator. They'll vent steam if they have to. They'll flush the reactor core. They'll insert the control rods, you know, all the way in and bring the reactor to standby condition. It's a whole series of things that are involved in that type of an emergency shutdown. And frankly, it's all done by computer. I mean, somebody hits that scram button, or if a certain number of the prioritized alarms happen in a certain sequence or a certain time relationship to one another, that whole thing goes down by itself because you can't afford to take the chance. Once those once that core temperature gets to the point where the fuel rods begin to melt or any of the other components that are internal to the reactor core itself become damaged, you no longer can control what's happening. So it has to be something that happens almost instantaneously. Now, the flushing pumps that I was referring to before in the place where I was working were powered by 8 5,000-horsepower diesel engines, which were always kept in standby mode. And they needed to be able to be started, synchronized, put online, and assume full load in some amazing amount of time, like 15 or 20 seconds. And that's also part of the scram procedure. Now, there's places where you can have some severe problems with that. In the Americanized version, those diesels were routinely started and run to make sure that they didn't have problems. The cooling oil was kept at running temperature all the time by heating elements in the holding tanks for the oil so that there wouldn't be any cold oil that could inhibit a start. The starting motors were constantly tested and made sure that they were in viable condition. And the synchronizers and all the electronic gear that goes along with putting those babies online together were routinely tested. Now, if any of that is handled in a slipshod manner, you do risk the possibility of not getting all the diesels online or maybe not getting any of them online. And that is that's a recipe for pure disaster. Now, I understand that what supposedly happened in Japan was that the wave from the tsunami somehow impacted the diesel area and interfered with the readiness of the standby situation. But what's not clear to me is, you know, what the main difficulty was in the first place. I mean, there should have been enough systems. We had 4 redundant systems in the reactor that I worked on, and it's pretty difficult. And they're all routed differently. The controls for them are in different places and things like that, if standard procedures are followed. So even if there is an earthquake, it's difficult for me to imagine that all 4, you know, shutdown systems would be put out of commission. Now, one of the things I did hear was that the temperature in the core exceeded a certain amount, and seawater got in there. Now, I don't honestly understand how that's possible, because in the systems that I worked on, even ones that were cooled by external water from a river, for instance, or from a bay, there was total isolation between the actual water that went into the reactor and the cooling water from the outside by means of huge heat exchangers. And I have a hard time believing that even with a 0.8 or 0.9 seismic disturbance that you would find so much salt water entering the reactor as to cause a chemical reaction with the zirconium or the cadmium control rods that would wind up releasing hydrogen gas. And frankly, even if that did happen, the containment building is designed to withstand an actual low-level nuclear blast. That's why it's called a containment building. If something really goes wrong, the idea is that the building is built well enough to contain whatever occurs in there, with the possible exception of going into a complete fission reaction, which is technically impossible in the normal sense of the term, if the geometry of the reactor core is properly laid out. But anyway, the fact that the domes were blown open on these reactors is very surprising to me. I don't think that even if hydrogen gas was released in sizable quantities, that there would be enough power from such an explosion, you know, to take the domes out on a well-designed containment building. I mean, they're only about 4 feet thick, maybe even more in the modern ones. They're utterly reinforced with welded steel re-rod configurations, and you know, supposedly it's high-grade concrete that's poured, you know, and it's supposed to be a well-managed pour, done with the same type of quality that you would expect to find in a hydro dam somewhere. You know, it's supposed to be an enormously strong structure. So it leads me to believe one of two things. Either the entire complex was built with substandard materials, and a lot of cheating went on in the course of its design and construction, you know, and somebody pocketed the change, which is always going on in these big construction endeavors, or there was some kind of sabotage involved. And if there was sabotage involved, then that raises another question. And that question is, you know, how would the saboteur know what day and what time an earthquake was going to strike? You know, that really stretches the imagination if you go down that road, because now you're forced to think in terms of conspiracy. So it's a complicated issue. I don't think we have enough answers to really say what happened one way or another. But if you want my gut feeling, the whole thing stinks.
Yes, mine. That's my gut feeling, too. I have a quick comment to make, and that is that should we expect that those that create wars and starvation and mass murder around the planet might be involved in a conspiracy? I just threw that rhetorical question out there for thought. Our BBSRadio.com in-studio board op, Seth Hendrick, sent us the following. The Fukushima units numbers 1 through 5 at Daiichi are older GE designed BWR-3 and BWR-4 MK-1 boiling water reactors that were all built in the 1970s. And then he sent a quote from an article that he found. He said it's a rather good sounding one. And I don't know who wrote this. I didn't go to the site, but I do have the text, the pertinent text. The individual is saying, I will say that though the 9.0 magnitude earthquake was beyond the design basis of the Fukushima 1 nuclear plant. The plant actually weathered the earthquake itself quite well and shut down as designed. It is the tsunami that caused the bulk of the problems that the plant operators now face. The backup emergency diesel generators actually started as designed and began to power the auxiliary pumps designed to circulate cooling water in the reactors. However, the tsunami arrived at the site and overflowed the seawall that was created to protect it from a tsunami. The height of the tsunami was also beyond the design basis of the plant. It is my understanding that the seawall was about 6.5 meters tall, and the height of the tsunami was above 7 meters. The tsunami destroyed the diesel fuel tanks for the emergency diesel generators and then flooded the below-ground switchgear rooms that contained the diesel generators themselves. Therefore, the diesel stopped running about an hour after they started. That seems to be on point with what you were saying, but it gives a little bit more specificity as to what happened to the generators themselves.
Only comment about that is, I am actually familiar with boiling water reactors. If the thing had gone into a scram condition and those diesels, and I don't know how many they actually have on site, but if they've got five reactors, they've got to have a mess of diesels. If all those babies came online like they were supposed to and ran for an hour, if they took all the other necessary precautions, I still don't see in an hour's time how they could have sustained so much damage to the cores.
Yes.
I mean, you're talking about flushing thousands and thousands of gallons per minute, you know, through those machines. And if the control rods went back in and the reactors were brought down to their standby levels, I still think that an hour is enough time that they could have averted the main part of the disaster. I think we're still missing something.
Mm-hmm. There's another aspect of this now, Jim. Wednesday, I had Z.S. Livingstone on the show, and we both sort of agreed intuitively as to what might be going on behind the scenes. And if I may, with your permission, read something that he submitted to Ken Adachi's website, educate-yourself.org. This is his intuitive take on what was going on. And during the show, we were pretty much in agreement about this. I've looked at enough information and it's becoming clear to me that there was something more that was left unsaid. Some may have been related to the recent problems Toyota had, or just in general, what they were planning on doing in Japan. The piece is called Japan is Developing Over-Unity Power Generators. Last month, there was an article of a Japanese corporation ready to ship electrical generators on steel boxes, which could supply all the electrical power needs for a small factory or an office building. The technology was new and not revealed in the article. It appeared over-unity power was coming into being. Then the earthquakes, the tsunamis, and the sabotage of the nuclear plants. The status quo did not want to allow this technology to replace the oil-based economy. Now, interestingly, I'm adding something to this, just a comment. I've found proof that that is correct, and discovered a company that is involved in consulting, especially in incidents of oil leaks and nuclear disaster cleanups. And that's an American company based in San Francisco. Going back to ZS's essay, since the first 7.2 earthquake March 9th, 2011, at 14.1 kilometers depth off the east coast of Honshu, man-made earthquakes showed as sharp spikes on the seismograms. By the way, Jim, I've seen these, and they begin with a percussive attack. There's not this gradual logarithmic swell leading to the peak of the event. It's starting at the peak and then dissipating energy as it goes along, as if it were an explosion or some sort of a scalar device being used. He goes on to say, the strength of the tremors was in the 4.7 to 6.1 range, stronger than the cluster of 4.7 to 5.1 artificial quakes which pulverized Port-au-Prince, Haiti. There were over 300 quakes before the 9.0 Richter quake on March 11, 2011. Unlike Haitian, the Bonin Island and the Gulf of Aden quakes were in tight clusters. The Japan earthquakes were spread over a large area between the line where the Pacific Plate subduction zone starts its slide under the Asian plate. This is similar to the artificial quakes off the coast of Chile, which also included a very large quake and a tsunami. The New World Order geoscientists had learned how to attempt to destroy Japan in attempting to destroy Chile. Japan was targeted because of the new technology and because it was refusing to be a part of the New World Empire based on oil. It was refusing to participate in the massive genocide, the killing of 90% of humanity, and so it became the focus of one of the attempted planet-wide murder plots. Looking at the ferocity of the earthquake attack, it appeared the plot was to utterly destroy Japan and kill tens of millions by unleashing a 150-foot tsunami, which would have destroyed all the coastal cities on the Pacific Ocean and depopulating all of Polynesia. Part of the plan was to detonate tactical nukes at the nuclear plants as the tsunamis swept over the top of the atomic cores, releasing hundreds of tons of uranium and other radioactive elements into the environment of half the Earth. It is likely there were similar tactical nukes hidden in the seven nuclear plants on the U.S. West Coast. The western USA would be laid to waste and the survivors forced into concentration camps. The FEMA rail cars were already in position in Seattle. It did not happen. By a miracle, it did not happen. The 9.0 Richter earthquake 250 miles northeast of Tokyo should have done more damage than it did. Tokyo can be repaired. The ports on the east coast can be rebuilt. The suitcase or tactical nukes breached just one of the four atomic pile cores, blasting through 7 inches of steel. These were not hydrogen explosions. The blasts were too powerful. Something blocked three of the bombs from tearing holes in the other reactors. Something deflected the energy. Even as this is written, another artificial 4.8 Richter, 30.4 kilometers deep off the east coast of Honshu earthquake on the 18th of March occurred. There have been nearly 1,000 quakes over 4.0 in the last month. More than half have been artificial. The New World Order is stubbornly keeping to its evil game plan. I would recommend Japan defy the New World Order and replace the nuclear plants with new technologies. The heavens and Mother Earth have prevented the destruction of Japan. The New World Order is losing ground. By this act, the New World Order has lost face. And that's from Zora Nova Star Livingstone, who was on the show this past Wednesday. Any comments?
Who is that person, Don?
Well, he's an intuitive, we'll put it that way. He has been one most of his life and has been writing some very interesting articles as to what's going on a planetary scale. They're actually essays, and they're featured on Ken Adachi's site.
Well, there's a couple of really interesting things in there. First of all, it's interesting that he agrees with my take on the situation that hydrogen blasts from internal problems in the reactors would definitely have been contained, even if they blew the lids off the reactors. The the fact that they may have been using suitcase nukes definitely demonstrates that there's conspiracy involved. And as I said in my little soliloquy there, there's no way that you could time that type of a thing to a natural earthquake. I mean, if in fact there were suitcase nukes installed, then it would have to be their devastation would have to be synchronized with the coming of the quake and the tsunamis in order to achieve that objective. And so naturally, the whole thing then becomes suspect for collusion.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that he mentions, which is interesting, the idea that, there's a possibility of some free energy devices or over-unity devices being developed in Japan is not completely out of line with what I've heard. More to the point, destroying Japan the way they have with this much damage, what I think the Japanese people should do is absolutely refuse any funding coming from the so-called traditional sources to rebuild. You know, the OITC and certain Eastern or Asian groups that have enormous amounts of real wealth, never mind fiat nonsense, hopefully will engage their processes to come to the aid of Japan. The only way that we're going to break the back of this financial monster is to starve it to death. And that means, don't play into its plans for lending money and keeping people subjugated, with interest on imaginary wealth. That's what they've done to our country. The money is loaned into circulation. It's not spent into circulation, and it has no real value. But you've got to work your tail off to pay the interest on it, and people don't realize that that's the kind of a stranglehold they're in. The only thing they know is the prices are going up. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Now, you mentioned Tom Bearden. I presume you're familiar with his book, Fer de Lance.
Yeah, I read Fer de Lance a long time ago, and while I don't recall it verbatim, I thought he had a lot of good stuff in there. Of course, nobody believed him at the time. But Tom is an interesting man. I know him personally, and he's had a lot of attacks on him over the years because of the things he's been trying to teach people. He was openly writing about various avenues that would bring you to free energy type conclusions in technological areas, and he was doing so without any concern for hiding, the methodologies employed, or without any concern for achieving any personal wealth out of the deal. And he was brutally attacked in a number of ways for doing this. As a matter of fact, his health has declined significantly as a result of these pressures that he's been put under and the attempts on his life and things like that. The book that he has just written, and I don't remember the name of it, but I would really like to get a hold of it, talks about the fact that, there's all kinds of natural evidence that mechanisms actually exist in nature that provide a so-called gain in the amount of work that can be done in a given system. And he talks about all the various suppressed inventions and goes also into the the more secretive aspects of alchemy, involving biological transmutations, and how the animal kingdom has been transmuting elements for years, ever since God created them, with very low level consumption of their personal power to do that. And so, you know, it just goes to show that all this business about super colliders and these ungodly powerful accelerators that they're building, certainly if they have the smarts that they think they have, and if their goal was really to understand atomic structure, then they wouldn't need to build such machines. They could simply investigate chickens and other animals that transmute elements all the time. And not only would it be less expensive, but it would be in step with natural processes. But obviously that's not what they're after. They're looking to find a way to tear a hole in the space-time continuum or turn a super collider into a nice weapon or something of that sort, which is more in keeping with their sick mentality.
Yes. Tom Bearden also references a few types of technology and some other people who were actually doing research in that regard. He mentions T.W. Barrett in his Tesla's Nonlinear Oscillator Shuttle Circuit, or OSC, theory. Then he mentions Annales de la Fondation by Louis de Broglie. He says Barrett shows that EM expressed in quaternions allows shuttling and storage of potentials in circuits and allows additional EM functioning of a circuit that a conventional EM analysis cannot reveal. He shows that Tesla's patented circuits did exactly this. And he gives the links to that. Then he says, now recall that Maxwell's actual theory is 20 quaternion-like equations in 20 unknowns. So Maxwell, who died in 1879, also knew that there were asymmetric EM systems as well as symmetrical EM systems. Barrett was so impressed by Tesla's insight and discoveries that he extended one of Tesla's patents with two extended process patents. They are Terence W. Barnett, Barrett, 1996, Active Signaling Systems, U.S. Patent Number 5,486,833, January 23, 1966. A signaling system in time-frequency space for detecting targets in the presence of clutter and for penetrating media. 14 U.S. patents cited, 22 claims, 37 drawing sheets. And then finally he references, again, Terence W. Barrett, Oscillator Shuttle Circuit, OSC Networks, for conditioning energy in higher order symmetry algebraic topological forms and RF phase conjugation, U.S. Patent Number 5,493,691, February 20th, 1996. So there is evidence that research was being done in this area, though those explanations I just gave do not go into adequate depth to describe what we have here. Would you like to comment on any of this, Jim?
Yeah, I would. First of all, the first thing I'd like you to do when you get a chance would be to forward me those patent numbers. I'd like to look at that material. The second thing is that, Bearden has been very concise and accurate over the years in the things he's been able to investigate and write about. And if he's basically saying that these two gentlemen, you know, have invested a lot of their time in this type of research, then my immediate suspicion is that they're probably onto something interesting. Now, when it comes to the asymmetrical aspects of Tesla's wave work, I know a great deal about it because I spent 20 years investigating it on my own. The other thing, which is even more important than the so-called Tesla wave function, is the fact that the other gentleman, of the French guy, I don't remember his name.
Broly?
And whatever you read before.
Yes.
He makes mention in the part that you read there about, you know, being able to manipulate potentials. Now, the whole thing that hides the true nature of electrodynamics as it pertains to motors and generators in our present era has to do with the difference between understanding energy in the potential form and so-called energy in the dynamic or kinetic form. The general belief is that all sources of losses have been identified because they all are associated with the release of heat unless they're converted directly into electricity. And so they've all been tagged, and there's a big list of them, which I won't go into, but they're all very well-known functions. What is not well-known is the fact that all of those losses which have been identified and categorized are minuscule compared to the major loss which prevents anyone who is working in this field from seeing over-unity proof, or proof of over-unity. And that is the fact that our systems and our instrumentation are not capable in the normal sense of measuring what we call potential degradation. It is a loss of energy in the form of a dissolved potential, and it can be disguised a million different ways. And the way in which it is disguised in the present systems has to do with the fact that the equations have been written in such a way as to make it look as if the applied electrical power is actually changed into the mechanical power that appears on the output shaft in a motor, or vice versa if it's in a generator. Now, the thing that's interesting about that whole deal is the fact that when one form of energy changes into another, it's kind of like having a big block of ice that's sitting on a rack above a tank. And as the ice melts, the water that was the ice before drips down and fills the tank. Well, you'll notice that the ice and the water in the tank do not coexist because one is changing into the other. So you have three possible conditions. You have all ice and no water. You have all water and no ice. Or you have a situation where there's so much water and so much ice, but the sum remains the same. Now, the interesting thing about electrodynamics is if you look at the equations for a motor, and if you go beyond the equations and look at the actual performance of a motor, there is no energy of one sort changing into energy of another sort. In other words, there's no electrical energy that's suddenly becoming mechanical energy. No matter how finely you divide the process, you find that the two coexist together. It's like two different sides of a coin. So it isn't a question of one changing into the other. It's a question of under the right circumstances, both of them exist. But they have manipulated the equations using degradation of potential in such a way as to disguise this fact and make it look or appear, especially to someone who's just learning the field and doesn't question anything, that one is actually turning into the other. But in reality, they exist simultaneously, which shoots down the idea of one changing into the other. So you actually have a condition that's a lot more in parallel with Bearden's thinking, that there's an interaction with pointing vector that causes the creation of these forces, and they are actually they are actually inhaled, if you want to use that term, by the electrodynamic system from the surrounding media, and that results in the transformation of this energy into the form that we're used to looking at. But it's not the true, but the true mechanism that makes it all possible is not disclosed. And so the concentration is then placed on the relationship between the electrical power that's entering the system on one end and the mechanical power that's exiting the system on the other end. And by conventional reckoning, one must equal the other. Well, you know, the fact that one equals the other doesn't really tell you anything. It's just a very fancy way of hiding the fact that if you didn't have potential degradation, the minimum you'd have would be a 500% efficient system. And, you know, this is well known in a lot of areas. The people have been investigating this stuff for a very long time. And, of course, they keep it close to the vest, you know, because of inventor paranoia and because of fear of the establishment and what have you. But the fact of the matter is that it's not a top secret anymore. Lots of people know about it.
Yes, but despite that, then you have these events, which appear on many levels to have been orchestrated. Certainly, you could induce an aftershock by introducing an artificial earthquake. What's so ridiculous about that? The issue is that they do this, and that they don't want the average individual out there to know this. Somehow we would then be able to organize and protest this in a sensible and productive way, and it would result in the complete collapse of this cabal that's wreaking all this havoc on the planet. If they were so certain that this was going to happen, and we get predictions, they're predicting, by the way, while this is going on, it's all being blamed on Planet X and the Elamine asteroid. And I remind the listening audience that we also have to look very closely at the microscopic worms found on meteorite fragments that are probably flying the flying saucers as we speak, because according to NASA, they may have found alien life. It's just one story after another, Jim, and I try my best to alert the listening audience to the fact that you're hearing opposite stories from the same source. Which one is real? Any comment?
Well, one thing I learned as a kid, which seems to carry a lot of weight, is that if you're going to be a liar, you have to have a damn good memory. Because sooner or later, you're going to outlie yourself. And the problem is, they got so many factions to this group of idiots that are running the world now that they can't even keep their own lies straight. And sooner or later, people are going to catch on to the fact that there's too many different versions of all of this. And not only pertaining to the current events, but pertaining to every darn thing. Everything from, you know, UFOs and aliens, life on Mars, to, you know, medical anomalies, to religious facts, to distortions in history, you name it. They're all lies, all of them.
Yes, the benefits of fluoride in toothpaste as well. Don't forget that one. That's the important one.
Well, there's another one. I mean, it's so common that people don't even flinch when you tell them. It's like, think about the nonsense with the catalytic converters in your car. Okay, so they were complaining that the cars are putting out carbon monoxide, and you know, that we can't have that because, heaven forbid, it's poisonous gas. Now, the fact that it immediately oxidizes by grabbing an oxygen molecule and becomes CO, which is necessary for all the plant life, CO2, which is necessary for all the plant life, that doesn't seem to enter into the picture. But if they can charge an extra $500 to stick a catalytic converter under your car, because they've managed to get rid of the terrible CO gas coming out of there, but what they don't tell you is that when that exhaust interacts with the catalyst that they have in there, instead of putting out the CO, now it's putting out sulfuric acid and other disgusting ingredients, which don't show up on the pollution index simply because they're not the ones that are highlighted for concern. But which would you rather breathe, you know? I mean, CO at least gives you a relatively painless death, but sulfuric acid fumes eat out your lungs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's everything is a lie. Everything. And that's about where we stand.
Yes. And again, this relates to the petroleum industry, too.
Well, sure. They're accomplished liars as well.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested in seeing what you could learn without jumping through any hoops to find out what might be going on or what might have been going on in Japan. Tom Bearden alleges that some years ago, the Japanese Yakuza invested $900 billion into leasing some of the technologies that they've been witnessing in Japan. Now, I'm not saying that they would do that to their own country, but this event also moved into the Kamchatka region of Russia, and you have an active volcano there as well. This is just too much stuff going on all at the same time. It's like they pulled out all the stops. Do you agree with that, Jim?
They can pull out all the stops they want. I'm telling you right now, and I'm telling you this not only from a gut level, but from a street smart level. Because the city I grew up in, you have to be pretty damn smart to survive by the time you were heading towards your teens. And you don't forget certain lessons. If they tick off the right people, there's going to be a bloodbath. And it's going to happen right in the United States, right in Washington. Wherever the main control group happens to be. If it isn't Washington, maybe it's Brussels. But wherever it is, and I don't pretend to know, they are not invulnerable, and they can be reached. And all they got to do is tick off the right people.
I agree. Well, Jim, we handled the subject quite efficiently, I feel, and we have a weekend coming up here, and you stay up late Friday night after Friday night for a number of years now. And so I want to give you a chance to enjoy the rest of the weekend, and thank you for your contribution to the show, and remind the listening audience that Jim Murray will be with us again next Friday. So I look forward to that, Jim. Any closing comment you would like to make? You made a pretty powerful one just now.
Well, it's just common sense. This can't go on indefinitely, you know. That's what that's based on. But as far as a closing comment is concerned, I would like to say that to our brothers and friends in Japan who are victims of this latest catastrophe, you know, my heart goes out to them, and anything that I can ever do to help, I will definitely do. And of course, those things that are beyond us personally, we would address God's help in helping that nation recover. And our hearts are lifted in prayer for that end.
Yes,
I know
well
you
said.
Feel the same way, Don.
Absolutely, Jim. We've been soliciting the prayers of people all around the planet. In fact, that will do much more good than sending money to the Red Cross. We can tell you that Haiti was just another money laundering, pilfering expedition. as well as Hurricane Katrina, and you would be better off dealing directly with Japanese organizations or people that you know over there if you feel compelled to send some financial relief. So, Jim, well taken, and I look forward to next week's show.
Okay, Don, thank you. Take care.
Folks, you too. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and tonight's special guest, scientist, inventor, Jim Murray. I want to thank Wind Talkers Radio Network, who I may have failed to mention at the top of the show, for broadcasting Evident Footprints. If I did not forget, then it doesn't hurt to remind everybody that we have folks around the world who are interested in the information coming out. Over at BBS Radio, we had Seth Hendrick on the sound tonight. I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday evening when my special guest will be Dr. A. Truott. In the meantime, I wish you a great weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.